You're listening to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. This is Jorge Fascinetti. Welcome. Today, Dr. Louis Blevins will be reviewing a very interesting article on hypopituitarism in adults. The article was recently published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Here's Dr. Blevins.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Louis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting to you from the coast of Northern California. Today, I want to review an article with you, and that article is entitled Hormone Replacement in Hypopituitarism in Adults, an Endocrine Society Clinical Practice Guideline. And for those of you who want to read the actual article yourself, it was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, Volume 101, and it's on pages 3,888 to 3,921. Published in the year 2016. Those of you who know me know very well that I'm opposed to guidelines and algorithms to practice medicine because I think that physicians should appropriately incorporate their knowledge and experience and devise an individualized treatment plan rather than going along with a group of guidelines from an established group of physicians. And of course, this attitude is one that I've developed over 26 years of the practice of pituitary endocrinology, and also having seen the consequences, or the negative consequences, if you will, of following guidelines in patients who have disease states. I could talk a lot about that later, but the purpose of today's podcast is to review this article. Overall, I thought it was a great article. I agreed with most of what was said. I felt like there have been some evolution in the recommendations that come across from this group to where the recommendations are more in keeping with what I would say is sound or solid clinical practice. So this is certainly one of those articles that maybe you should get a copy of and take to your treating physician if you're seeing an endocrinologist who doesn't focus on pituitary diseases so that they can be informed. And I would consider doing that especially if there were some contentions about certain aspects of evaluation or management of your particular case. Back to the article. This article is divided into two major parts. The first is summary of recommendations, and then the second is a very well-written, what I would refer to, state-of-the-art review on hypopituitarism that sort of backs up the summary of recommendations. And for this podcast, I'll just go through the summary and recommendations so that you can have a general sense about what this article is all about. Okay, first topic, central adrenal insufficiency. This is where the pituitary does not make enough ACTH to drive the adrenal glands. They suggest measuring cortisol levels at 8 to 9 in the morning as a first-line diagnostic test for adrenal insufficiency. I tend to do that. A cortisol level less than 5 is diagnostic. They suggest less than 3, but research that I've done suggests less than 5 would be diagnostic of adrenal insufficiency based on using insulin tolerance tests. They also suggest that a cortisol level greater than 15 excludes adrenal insufficiency. In my research, I've found a level of 12. So we're not far from the numbers there. And the general sense is if your cortisol level is reasonable, you probably don't have adrenal insufficiency. If it is low, frankly low, then you do have adrenal insufficiency and further testing is not required. Now, this is in people who have documented pituitary disease, not just people off the street. People come off the street with no pituitary disease and these numbers that are low, you have to sort of evaluate why and try to figure that out. It's a little more complex. So in patients with pituitary disease, these cutoffs seem to work pretty well. They suggest performing a cortisone stimulation test if the levels are between 3 and 15. That's my approach as well, and I tend to usually do the low-dose ACTH stimulation test. I think it's more sensitive than is the traditional stimulation test. Next topic, central hypothyroidism. They recommend checking a free T4 and also a TSH, but in patients with documented pituitary disease, a low normal free T4 is highly suspicious of having central hypothyroidism, and they recommend treatment in that setting. There are no dynamic tests for TSH secretion that we find useful, The TSH levels can be either normal, low, or elevated in central hypothyroidism, so they're not a lot useful, but it's nice to at least have a baseline result. The other thing I would say about central hypothyroidism here, and we've had articles on this in the past, is that you cannot use TSH to decide on thyroxine adjustments, the goal for treatment we'll talk about later. Growth hormone deficiency. So in patients with suspected growth hormone deficiency, a stimulation test has to be done. We've covered that in other podcasts, and I agree with their recommendations that patients have a stimulation test if you suspect growth hormone deficiency. However, and I agree with their recommendation here, if a patient has three other documented pituitary hormone deficits with clear-cut features of growth hormone deficiency and a low IGF-1, you don't need to do additional stimulation testing. Central hypogonadism in men. So usually we check testosterone, LH, and FSH to diagnose it. Low normal levels might be significant and in need of treatment. Definitely normal levels usually rule out hypogonadism. In women, the presence of normal menses usually indicates that there's no evidence of pituitary dysfunction in regards to control of the ovaries. However, in women who are having irregular menses or no periods whatsoever or postmenopausal, we check the estradiol, FSH, and LH levels. Let's now turn our attention to their recommendations regarding treatment. With regards to central adrenal insufficiency, they recommend treating with hydrocortisone 15 to 20 milligrams total in single or divided doses. Some patients take two doses, some people take three doses, but certainly no more than 20 milligrams a day. So some people might take 10 in the morning, 5 in the lunchtime, and 5 in the late afternoon, for example. I tend not to use hydrocortisone. I tend to use a longer-acting steroid known as dexamethasone because it has less mineralocorticoid effect. And hydrocortisone has such a short half-life that patients sometimes have symptoms of adrenal insufficiency in between doses and certainly prior to bedtime. And dexamethasone alleviates all of that. They actually suggest using longer-acting glucocorticoids such as dexamethasone in selected cases. I tend to use it in a majority of my patients, and hydrocortisone is probably 10% of my practice, I would guess. Obviously, they recommend that clinicians teach patients regarding adrenal insufficiency and stress doses and emergency administration. They did come across recommending for adrenal crisis that patients use parenteral injectable steroids. I have abandoned that practice just because of the short shelf life, if you will, of the prepared medications. And tend to ask patients to just take extra oral and get to the emergency room to get parenteral steroids. Treatment of central hypothyroidism, they recommend thyroxine, levothyroxine, I should say, a synthetic form of thyroid hormone that's identical to what the thyroid gland makes, and to treat such that the free T4 levels are in the mid to the upper half of the normal range. I certainly agree with that recommendation. They suggest against using T3, thyroid extracts and other formulations, and most endocrinologists will suggest against those things. Some of us will use those preparations in patients who have impaired deiodination or intolerance to pure thyroxine. And obviously, as I mentioned earlier, we don't use TSH levels to decide whether the dose is appropriate. We check the free T4 and the T3 levels. So if your physician is checking your TSH after you've been diagnosed with central hypothyroidism, they're wasting your money and also potentially looking at a test result that might lead to errors in the management. For example, patients with pituitary disease have low TSH results or ineffective or biologically inactive TSH molecules, and when you take thyroid hormone, your TSH might still be low. If a physician is thinking as they would in a patient with primary thyroid disease, they would tend to want to lower your dose of thyroid hormone. So you can't use TSH. You have to use the T4 and the T3 levels. For central hypogonadism in men, they recommend testosterone replacement in those settings where there is no contraindications, such as prostate cancer, for example. And they state the benefits are to prevent anemia, reduce fat mass, improve bone mineral density, libido, sexual function, energy levels, sense of well-being, muscle mass, and strength. And those are certainly the things that we do see in patients who have hypogonadism who take testosterone. For women, they recommend hormone replacement in premenopausal women with central hypogonadism, provided there are no contraindications. I do also treat some postmenopausal women with typical postmenopausal hormone replacement to alleviate symptoms of menopause. Next, growth hormone replacement. They recommend offering growth hormone replacement to patients with growth hormone deficiency and no contraindications, starting with a lower dose and then escalating the dose in small increments as necessary to find the least amount necessary. And titrating doses based on IGF-1 levels such that they're below the upper limit of normal, certainly in the upper half of the normal range is where we aim to treat. They do recommend against treating elderly patients with low IGF-1 levels who have no documented pituitary disease, and I certainly concur with that recommendation. In the next section of the article, I was pleased to see that they reported some interactions between replacement hormones, and I certainly help my patients become aware of these. The first one is glucocorticoids and growth hormone, and it's important to know that growth hormone administration can accelerate the metabolism of cortisol and might unmask mild central adrenal insufficiency, so they recommend testing patients for such prior to starting treatment if you haven't already done so. It might also lead to increased clearance of hydrocortisone, so that's one of the reasons I use dexamethasone. It doesn't lead to increased clearance of dexamethasone. So I've seen patients who are on hydrocortisone started growth hormone before we knew about this clearance problem, and then they became more relatively adrenally insufficient, and it was because of that accelerated clearance of hydrocortisone and the need to go ahead and transition them over to a longer-acting steroid. Glucocorticoids and thyroid hormone. We all know that patients who have central hypothyroidism and maybe central adrenal insufficiency, if you give thyroid hormone first, you will accelerate the clearance of glucocorticoids and prompt adrenal insufficiency. So again, we have to test beforehand, and patients might require an adjustment of glucocorticoid dosage when they start thyroid hormone. They point out that estrogens can increase cortisol binding globulin levels and thus increase total cortisol levels, but free cortisol levels might still be somewhat low. They recommend monitoring thyroid functions in patients who have hypopituitarism and start growth hormone because you may see an increased thyroid hormone dose requirement. That's rare, but I have seen that on occasion, so we continue to check those levels over time. It's important to recognize that estrogens increase thyroid binding protein, so a woman who starts estrogens may need an increase in her thyroid hormone dosage. Likewise, a woman who stops estrogens may need a decrease in her thyroid hormone dosage. And furthermore, estrogens also inhibit IGF-1 generation. So what we see is that patients who have who are postmenopausal or premenopausal taking estrogens, they will require higher doses of growth hormone. And the converse is such that if a patient on growth hormone and estrogen stops estrogen, she will require a lower dose of growth hormone. That's pretty much about all I wanted to cover from this article. As I mentioned, it's basically two major parts, and the second part is rather quite a good review on some of these issues that have already been discussed. And I think that if you have hypopituitarism, you probably want this article, so go out there and try to find it. Go to your local hospital or medical school library and ask if you can get a copy of this paper for your own files. I think it's that important, and that's why I wanted to cover it in this podcast. So again, thank you for listening. This has been Dr. Lewis Blevins. Have a wonderful day.